Almost 8 o'clock. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Take off. Welcome to this morning's talk. And as you know, when I give Dhamma talks, you try and make, especially the morning talks, informative and focused on the path of meditation, but not only just giving what you can read in books, but actually giving a little bit more explanation, information on, you know, what these things really mean and how you practice them. It's fine if you, say, go into the teachings of the Buddha, the suttas. But as the old saying goes, we know what the Buddha said, but what did he mean? It all depends upon the translations and actually how you understand the Dhamma well enough and have a wide understanding of the use of those terms so you understand what the Pali means. And I must admit, I was fortunate that I learnt my Pali by learning the monk's Vinaya. Because in the Vinaya, which is also, you know, it's part of the legacy of the Buddha, they always used to call it the Dhamma Vinaya, so the suttas and the Vinaya. And the Vinaya teachings is about what happens in real life, not the philosophical stuff, as much as real life, what happens to people and how they act. And so the words they use there are just, you know, the common words which, you know, people use all the time. And, for example, like one of the stories there in the Vinaya about, you know, lighting the oil lamp, and they would say what happens when the lamp, the flame goes out. When I saw that the first time reading in Pali, this really old language, the word they use that the flame has gone out of the oil lamp, Nibbana. The flame had Nibbana'd. And so that was, even the kids understood what the word Nibbana meant. Even little boys and girls in the village. And that was the word which the Buddha used, you know, for, you know, the obvious, the enlightenment. So these are little experiences you get when you read this stuff for yourself. And of course, you know, some of those stories in the Vinaya are just very amusing as well. Please excuse me, but I think you know, probably know what's going to come next. The eighth Pajitya rule for the bhikkhunis. Because this was, you can read this in the Vinaya, this is 2,500 years old and a bit more, that in the bhikkhuni monastery in the time of the Buddha. So, you know, when we ordained bhikkhunis, I know the anniversary is coming up on Thursday, the 11th anniversary of the bhikkhuni ordination. But anyway, in the Vinaya there, in the eighth Pajitya rule, the bhikkhunis were staying in a monastery, and, you know, it was just on the edge of town because they needed a bit more security and safety. And it was one of the duties of the bhikkhunis to empty the latrines in the morning and take the, you know, they didn't have sanitation like we have these days. They had little buckets and had to just put them in the place where it would all be fermented or whatever. But this bhikkhuni, early in the morning, it was her job to do this, and she was a lazy bhikkhuni. So instead of throwing it away in the proper place, she threw it over the monastery wall. Now, people many years ago, they used to do that, you know, even in places like England. Any sort of rubbish, they'd throw out the window and outside. They keep their own house clean, but not outside. But anyway, that's early in the morning before, you know, dawn. No one will be walking outside, they thought. But there is one of the teachings, the laws of nature, which even is before the revelation of the Dhamma. It's what we call in science Murphy's Law. If it can happen, it will happen. So when she threw the bucket of poo over the wall, on the other side, there was a businessman going off to the palace to discuss a contract with the king. So he was especially well dressed. Yeah, exactly. And as he was walking, you know, thinking about the deal to be discussed with the king, wearing his best clothes, this bucket of poo came all over his head and his clothes. And he knew what was on the other side of the wall, the nuns. And he wasn't at all impressed. In fact, he turned around. Those days they had the lighting for the street was little torches, like flames. So he grabbed one of those torches and he was going to run into the nuns' monastery to burn it down. Look what they've done to me. They can't do this to me, throwing poo all over me, you know, in the early morning. This is not right. These aren't real nuns. And he was running into that monastery really upset and angry. But they had a gatekeeper there, you know, to try and make sure the nuns were safe. And the gatekeeper saw him really incensed and all sorts of brown stuff dripping down his nice clothes. And he said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Look what they did to me. These aren't real nuns. I'm going to burn their place down." Now, if you have like an attendant or a gatekeeper or a caretaker or a retreat manager, they always have to be very smart and intelligent, as this fellow was. And he took one look at this really irate businessman. He said, "Wow, you mean you've been blessed by the holiest of holy water from these highly attained nuns?" You know, because I do holy water, but I do the, you know, the easy stuff, the, you know, the water stuff. This was the real stuff, right from the source. And he said, "You are so lucky. That is so fortunate. That's so rare to be blessed like that from these holy nuns." And it always amazes me how people will believe this rubbish. But they did. He said, "Really?" He said, "Yes." He said, the caretaker said, listen, this is what you should do. Just go home, just, you know, change, get showered or something. That is an omen. That is a prediction. You're going to really do well when you go and visit the palace." "Really?" "Yeah. So put away that, you know, that trying to burn the monastery down. Go and get changed. You've been blessed." And he did that. And he went to the palace and he got this really, really good contract. A really big money spinner for him. You know what business people do? They always, you know, they tell their friends how things are going. And that's what this businessman did. He said, "Look, if you really want to make a lot of money and have your business really go up to the next level, go and get some real holy shit from those nuns." And when the Buddha heard about that, he said, "Okay, come over here." He said, "You're very lucky to get away with it once, but don't do it again." And that became the eighth paccitya for the bhikkhunis. Thou shalt not throw buckets of shit over the monastery wall. If you don't believe me, you can read it, it's there. And it's almost exactly that way it was told. So it's a story, and it's entertaining, it's funny. Never think that in those days they didn't have a sense of humour. I can imagine some teaching that story to people and all, they just fall over laughing. So, human beings being human beings. But, in particular, not only do you understand much more about what these words mean, but you get some really great insights into the practice of meditation. And the one thing which I haven't talked about yet, which nearly all meditation retreats talk about, is the Satipatthana. Are you interested? Nah, not interested enough. So let's talk about something else. No, because that is an important part of the Dhamma, but please excuse me, it has been exaggerated, given more importance than it truly deserves. There's not just a one-fold path, not the Satipatthana. But there's a whole eightfold path. And you can't have one without the other. So first of all, where did the Satipatthana and its connection with mindfulness and the whole mindfulness tradition in our modern world actually come from? And I think recently, about a year or 2 years ago, there's a couple of books which were written by scholars. And these were books, you know, where did this mindfulness separated from everything else in Buddhism come from? And they can only do this because there was a market. There was only a market because mindfulness was now popular in the world, even teaching US Marines how to shoot accurately and kill with mindfulness. It's weird, isn't it? But that's what they did. But anyway, where did that all come from? And I must admit, it was my ancestors' fault. The Brits. Because what happened, the English went to Burma. And when they were in Burma, they managed to conquer Mandalay, which was, you know, almost like the heartland city of Burma at that time. And the monks in Burma got terrified. They thought this was going to be the end of the real Dhamma in that country. And especially there was one very well-known monk at the time. His name was Ledi Sayadaw, L-E-D-I, Sayadaw. And they made the word Sayadaw as the name, you know, to recognize him as a teacher in the monastery or the town of Ledi. So if I was Burmese, or the Burmese tradition, I'd be called either Bodhinyana Sayadaw or Serpentine Sayadaw. And Ajahn Jakro, who was the abbot before me, he would have had that title, Bodhinyana Sayadaw. So the next monk would also be Bodhinyana Sayadaw. So this is a Ledi Sayadaw of about 120, 130, 40 years ago. And when he saw that the British had taken over the heartland of Burma, he thought, wow, that's the end of the real Dhamma. So how can I strengthen people's faith in Buddhism and get them to have more people become Buddhists in that land? So what he did, you know, he started focusing the meditation more on the mindfulness and less on the peace and stillness, less focusing on the jhanas, and more on mindfulness. And he did that, please excuse me, but he stated this as a way that more lay people can actually get some confidence and success in their meditation. And as for the monks were always expected to do the full Eightfold Path, culminating in the jhanas. And that's where it started. And from Ledi Sayadaw, it went on to a few other Sayadaws, like the former Mahasi Sayadaw, and from there to many lay teachers, into the Vipassana tradition as we know it, and the Vipassana tradition to the United States, where especially, you know, John Kabat-Zinn did a huge, wonderful work to introduce that into hospitals and schools. So that's actually where it originally came from. It was my ancestors' fault. I apologize. Not really, but anyway. So what is actually the difference there? Sometimes when, you know, you look at the Dhamma yourself, that there is no difference between insight and stillness, between samadhi and sati. And even Ajahn Chah, you know, when he was asked, you know, what do you practice? Do you practice vipassana, or do you practice anapanasati? What do you practice, you know, insight or calm? And he would just put up his hand like this. He said, now you can see the front of my hand. You can't see the back of my hand. Now you can see the back, but you can't see the front. But even though you can't see the front of my hand, the front of the hand is still there, just you're focusing on the back of the hand. Now you're focusing on the front. You can't split up the hand. Wherever the back is, there the front is. Wherever the front is, there the back. The two always go together. And I heard him say that so many times when people asked him about samatha vipassana, insight and calm. He said, they're indivisible. And then my story, because you can't always tell the same old story, and that's a very short story, so I did a lengthy story. And my story is about the couple who were living together. They were good meditators. And his name was Sam, surname Atta, Sam Atta. And his partner was Vi, surname Pasana. So Sam Atta and Vi Pasana were, living together. And one afternoon after dinner, they decided to go on a walk up Meditation Mountain. And of course, when they went for a walk up Meditation Mountain, they took their two dogs. One of the dogs was called Metta, and the other dog was called Anapanasati. So Sam and Vi, Anapana and Metta, went up the mountain together. Now Sam, because he was into calm and peace and stillness, he went up there to enjoy the incredible calm and peace which you will all experience on Meditation Mountain. His wife, Vi, she went up there carrying an amazing camera with all sorts of filters and zoom lenses and everything else, because she wanted to get some nice insight snaps. And the lovely thing about Metta the dog, she went up there just for fun. Same Anapana went up there for fun. Sometimes I wonder, dogs are much wiser than humans. Are they? Certainly they have a less complicated life. So anyway, Sam, Vi, Metta and Anapana went up the mountain. When they got halfway up, or even halfway up, was so peaceful and calm. So Sam was really enjoying the peace and the stillness. And even halfway up, you could see a long way, so Vi was taking these shots. Amazing views. You could see, almost so far. And Metta, the dog, what happens when dogs are happy? They wag their tail. So Metta, the dog, was wagging her tail, really happy little dog. Because I'm halfway up Meditation Mountain, there's a lot of love for all beings. And Anapana, she was vanishing. Could hardly see her. She was disappearing halfway up Meditation Mountain. And when they got to the top of Meditation Mountain, whoa. That was so quiet, so peaceful. Sam was so happy with a deep peace and stillness on top of Meditation Mountain. And Vi, his wife, wow, you could see such amazing views, like the whole universe was laid out in front of you. Click, click, these amazing insights that Vi was photographing. And Metta the dog was so happy, she was wagging her tail like it would fall off. Anapana disappeared by now. But even though that Sam went up there for the peace, he had a pair of eyes too. And he could see forever and enjoy the view as well as the stillness. And he could also experience a great love and kindness on top of Meditation Mountain. Vi, well, as well as taking her incredible snaps of reality from up top, she could also feel the peace, the stillness. Sometimes she didn't even want to press the shutter of the camera to take a shot because it might disturb the peace. She did it so softly. And she could also experience a great love and happiness on top of Meditation Mountain. And the dog, little dog, Metta, was wagging her tail, but so silently, because she too worshipped the silence and didn't want to destroy it, and could see for so far, all over. And the meaning of that little simile is that on top of Meditation Mountain, your breath gets so quiet you don't need to breathe anymore, it disappears. Anapana vanishes. And on top of Meditation Mountain, insight and stillness exist together. And the one thing which I added there, it's not just insight and stillness, it's just great, great compassion as well. You cannot separate those three. They're all aspects of the same experience when you go up to Meditation Mountain, or these days, inside the Meditation Mountain. The deeper you get into meditation, the more kindness you have. It's not you develop it, it just happens. Stillness, calm, insight and happiness. So that was my simile. I really like that one, because if it's my simile, I can always keep developing it. Adding a bit on here and a bit off on there. Because that's what stories are. Stories are never supposed to be frozen. Always, you know, every add a little bit here, add a little bit there. To make it more meaningful. But the Buddha's simile was also very informative. And being in that time when it was either agricultural similes or military similes, he chose like a government simile of the king, the emperor of this big land, who had a son. And he knew that one day his son would have to take over ruling the empire. No elections on those days. So, how can you train your son? So what he did, he chose one of the outlying provinces, a long way from the capital, and said to his son when he was of age, this is going to be yours, this little region. So you can be the king, the emperor, whatever you wish to call yourself, in this little region. So, you can make mistakes, because that's the only way we learn. And you can run that kingdom, and that's how you can learn how to rule. You can't do too much wrong into this little land a long way away. So he sent his son there. And remember, this was his son's first time away from home. So what do they do? What do your sons do when you send them to university for the first time? Party! Oh, I still remember this Malaysian lady who, she was sent to Perth. This was years ago. She was sent to Perth by her family, to study. And just a few days before the end of the year exam, she came to see me to get some chanting. It's a blessing for her her success in her exams. I should have sent her to the nuns, and then she got the proper blessing, holy water. But no, I just gave her a blessing. I never saw her again. But her friends came up to say, look, Ajahn Brahm, that girl you blessed, a couple of days before exam, she failed. She failed her exams. And she's going around telling everybody that monk Ajahn Brahm's no good. Because his charity didn't work. And her friend said, look, don't worry about that, because look, she didn't do any work at all, hardly went to any lectures. She's been spending all the time partying, the first time away from home. Family's over in Malaysia, she's in Perth, party time. So she thought going to university in the West was the time to enjoy herself, and Ajahn Brahm will take care of the exams. It doesn't work that way. So, but anyway, you can understand, the first time away from home, kids sometimes, they mess around a bit. And that was the case with the prince, the son of the emperor. First time away from the palace, outside of his father's view, he had party and celebration, playing sports, and eating a lot, just enjoying his senses, because he could. And so all of the senior people of that district, the headman and the judges, they all came to see the emperor and said, look, your son is really messing around. He's just creating havoc in the place. He's just partying all the time. Please do something. So the emperor asked one of his wisest ministers, can you please go and tell my son how to rule the empire? It's okay to have some pleasure, but do some work as well. So the minister went up there and asked to see the emperor, or the little emperor's son up there. And the emperor said, "Yeah, who are you?" He said, "I've been sent here by your father. I'm one of his ministers to teach you how to rule the empire in this little land which you're in." And the little prince said, "Get out of here. This isn't your land, this is my land. I can do whatever I like in here. Get off, get away. But my father sent me. I don't care who sent you. Get out." So he sent the wise minister away. Wouldn't listen to the minister. So the wise minister went back to the capital, told the emperor, and the emperor said, "Oh, it's my fault. I'll send two of you next time, the wise minister and the fiercest general in the army, this big guy with really sharp swords and scars all over him. The two of you can go and teach my son how to rule the little province." So the two of them went, and when the prince saw the minister come back in, "Look, I told you to get out of here." But then the general came up, and he grabbed the prince by the throat, got out his sword and put the sword to his head. "Prince, I think you should listen to this guy, this minister." "I'm listening, I'm listening, I'm listening." And with the general holding the prince still, the minister could teach him what needed to be done. And that way, the prince learned the responsibilities as well as the enjoyment of being a leader in that land. And that was a simile which the Buddha gave. And he said, the wise minister stands for insight. And the general holding the prince still at the tip of a sword, that stands for stillness, samadhi. He said, you need two to teach the stupid princes in life, you and princesses. And that was the wonderful Buddha story. You can't separate, and insight by itself doesn't work. You get all the theory, you know what you should be doing, but you don't do it. But with something holding you still, then you read, and the message really comes home. So that's actually with the stillness and with the insight. They always go together. And sometimes when people come up and say, "Well, you know, I've got all these great insights. I really understand non-self. I understand suffering. I understand impermanence. I understand everything." But can you be still? Can you sit down there nice and peacefully without worrying about a thing? If not, why not? The reason is because you haven't understood fully. And sometimes people say, "Oh, I was really still, very, very peaceful." They say, "What did you understand from that?" "Oh, I wasn't doing insight, I was just doing stillness." And that wasn't stillness. The two always go together. The measure of your stillness is how far you see and how clear you see up on top of Meditation Mountain. That's how you know you're really still and peaceful. And the sign of your insight is how deeply you can let go and have some peace in this world. Deep peace sometimes. So the sign of insight is your stillness. The sign of stillness is the insight, is the two always go together. So when it comes to Satipatthana, the seventh factor of the Eightfold Path, again, that was one of the first books I read, the Satipatthana Sutta, when I was a student. The Buddhist Society of Cambridge University that had a library, and I didn't know what I was doing. I thought, this book looks interesting. I took it out, and it was the Satipatthana translated by these two Sri Lankan monks. And what I always remember was the introduction, the foreword, because these two monks had said they'd heard and they'd read. They knew that if you practice Satipatthana properly, within 7 days you can become fully enlightened. If not fully enlightened, at least a non-returner. In 7 days. How many 9-day retreats have you done? I said, wow, what's wrong? And when I read that, I said, and they did the 7 days, but then they did another 7 days. I think they did 3 retreats over in Burma. And they still weren't enlightened yet. At least they were honest enough to say that. So they decided, well, you know, it wasn't working, so they decided to translate from the Pali into the English instead. So it was the first time that, not the first time, but the best translation of the Satipatthana Sutta at that time. And I thought, I had enough confidence and faith in his teachings that Buddha doesn't exaggerate or lie. If they had become enlightened after 7 days, was the Buddha lying and exaggerating? Or was it the case they hadn't been doing it properly? And the latter, they hadn't been doing it properly. That was obviously the reason. It's nice to think you're doing Satipatthana, but are you really doing it properly? And so that when I started looking at it with a bit more clarity, right at the very beginning, there was a phrase for every time you do Satipatthana practice. I already mentioned it once to you here on this retreat. The prerequisite, what you've got to do beforehand, before you do Satipatthana. It's just like if you're planting a garden, you've got to sort of have some good soil to plant the plants in. If you don't plant the plants in the gravel, that's not going to grow. Or, you know, if you plant it in sort of sand with no nutrients in at all, that's not going to grow. You've got to have good soil. Preparation is so important. So if you're building, you've got to make sure you've got some good soil and not too much clay in it, or you put reinforcing, otherwise the building's going to crack. So preparation was really important with building, with gardening, with anything in life. So what was the preparation for the Satipatthana? First of all, vinaya lokaya bija domanasang. And the nice thing was that was always translated, as I mentioned already, having abandoned grief and covetousness for the world. Grief for the world? Sometimes you have grief if someone you don't like gets elected, or, you know, if a loved one dies, or something goes wrong in life. But grief for the world? And covetousness for the world. Maybe I might covet a cup of tea with condensed milk, but not the world. The whole translation never made sense. And you realize that these were, Westerners, this was Rhys Davids, trying his very best, but, you know, not really sort of having enough experience and immersion in meditation and Buddhism to really understand what he's talking about. An example of that is this Professor I.B. Horner. She was at Cambridge, and she was a great translator of the suttas and of the Vinaya. And she came across this nun's rule. He says that if a nun is traveling in dangerous places, she can have what's called satha, S-A-T-T-H-A. And that has two meanings. One of the meanings is caravan. The other meaning is knife. And I.B. Horner, not really sort of being too familiar with Buddhism, chose 50-50 chance knife, like a sword. So she said, well, you know, exceptional circumstances, if you're travelling, you can carry a sword with you. No way in the world would that be acceptable if you knew what Buddhist monks and nuns were. But it obviously meant going with a caravan, because in a caravan, numbers give you a bit of safety. So that sometimes, with all the best wood in the world, I don't want to be too critical, because these people did a huge amount of good service for everybody. But anyway, that when I started reading in Pali, I love reading in Pali because you're getting closer to the Buddha's real words. And I came across the words again and again and again and again. Lokaya bija. The first of the five hindrances. It was a synonym. The usual word is kamachanda. But synonyms sometimes are used lokaya bija. I read that for myself. Hey, this is weird. That's the first hindrance, but it's Lokiya Bija and the first part of the Satipatthana. And Vyapada. And here's a synonym, also Dhammanasang, a synonym for Vyapada, the second of the five hindrances. And that's in two suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya. It is the five hindrances, and the second one is Dhammanasa. That's the grief part of translation in the Satipatthana Sutta. So, hey, these are the first two hindrances. Having restrained, having lessened, having subdued, not overcome yet, the first two hindrances. That's what the Satipatthana Sutta was asking you to do before you even start Satipatthana. To lessen them, reduce them. And the other thing which you came across later on reading was when you have a group of, say, four or five or six or seven or eight factors, sometimes just out of, you might call it laziness, but mostly brevity, by mentioning the first two of a well-known sequence, the other members of that sequence are also included. So in other words, when they say having lessen, reduce, restrain the first two hindrances, it also means the other three as well. And then, of course, I started looking at the official commentaries to the Satipatthana Sutta, and this was, you know, what people are supposed to follow all the time. You know, this is how the old monks understood. And that's what they say in both the Satipatthana Suttas. There's one in the Majjhima Nikaya, one in the Digha Nikaya. They say that what it means is having restrained the first five, having restrained the five hindrances. Then you do the Satipatthana. And the reason why those two well-meaning Sri Lankan monks had not got as deep as they could have done was because they forgot that having restrained the five hindrances is a prerequisite of doing Satipatthana. That's a little bit of a long argument, but I keep saying that argument simply because people get confused sometimes. You know, they say, oh, there's Satipatthana, you can just do Satipatthana, that's enough. Yeah, but you have to reduce the five hindrances. How do you reduce the five hindrances? By having a reasonably good view, by having good intentions, making peace, being kind, being gentle, having your good precepts, sama vaca, sama kammanta, sama jiva, doing the restraint of the four restraints of the samavayama, sometimes called right effort. Those are prerequisites. That's how you get to be able to be ready to do some of the Satipatthana. And even the eighth factor of samadhi, every time you meditate, you don't even, not even going into jhanas yet, but you can find your mind gets clearer. You're reducing your five hindrances. When you're here on this retreat, you're not wanting so much because there's basically nothing to want. Everything's provided, nice and simple. Your food, is it delicious? Mm-hmm. Amazing, isn't it? So you get really nice food. Is it expensive? It's free. Oh, you've got to wash up afterwards, but that's not much for a good meal. And what else do you want here? Is your room's comfortable? Toilet's okay? What else do you want? It's weird, isn't it? You come to a place, there's nothing I want. You can't be contacted from by your family, which is a wonderful thing, to that's what you have to do. Have a bit of peace and quiet. So you're wanting your ill will here? Oh, you know, just every now and again, sometimes you're in a bad mood or something, but you tell a stupid joke like the coffin story. Bub, bub, bub. You shouldn't encourage me to tell stories like that because I love telling them. Now, you may have heard that coughing joke before, but I've heard it more than you. Every time I tell it, I hear it again. But, you know, I love it. I enjoy it. Have good fun. And, okay, this story is, I think we might call the retreat manager's fault. She said, are you going to tell the carrot joke?
If you say something like this, I just can't resist. I have to tell it. How many of you have heard or remember the carrot joke? One? That's all, two, three, four. Okay, not that many. More hands coming up now. You're going to hear it anyway, so. So two carrots were walking down St. George's Terrace. And some drunk driver lost control of their car, went into the pavement and hit one of the carrots. The other carrot got out his mobile phone and called 000 and got an ambulance really quickly. The ambulance officers took one look at the injured carrot. This was serious. So put him in the back of the ambulance and they sped to Royal Perth Hospital. His friend, the uninjured carrot, went along as well, really concerned. When they got to the hospital, the triage nurse took one look at the injured carrot. This really is serious. Emergency surgery. It was life or death. While the uninjured carrot was in the waiting room. And of course, you know, because it's part of my job to be of service and help people, I've been in that waiting room so often. And, you know, that people are just so terrified. They're so tense. This is life and death. Someone they love so much. You know, might die, might disappear, and they just don't know. So for 2 hours, they did surgery on this injured carrot, and after 2 hours, the surgeon came in and said, oh, you must be injured Mr. Carrot's friend. There's only one other carrot in the waiting room. And he said, I've got some good news and bad news for you. He said, the good news is because we managed to get to him early, we've saved his life. Your friend is going to live. Oh, what a relief. What's the bad news? But unfortunately, because of his injuries, he's going to be a vegetable for the rest of his life.
It's okay to groan. Just don't throw anything. That's a stupid carrot joke. But anyway, those jokes, actually, they do lessen, surprise, surprise, ill will, even towards me. It makes life for you when we laugh at life instead of getting angry at life. So actually, we lessen the five hindrances first. And the other lovely way of doing that, of course, is with your meditation. What does that mean, lessening the five hindrances? It increases the mindfulness. Everyone's mindful, even drunk people. You know, they come home at night, somehow they manage to find their way home. They got a tiny bit of mindfulness, enough for them to get back home. Not much, though. Ordinary people have ordinary mindfulness. But then when you meditate, you get powerful mindfulness. And I love focusing on that. That's one of the reasons why we sit here and meditate. And sometimes you think, oh, it wasn't a good meditation, because you didn't get joy and happiness and lights in the mind. But I bet you get more mindfulness afterwards. You can feel more. You can see more. The lunch tastes more delicious. And it's amazing. I asked you, was the food delicious? You say, it is. It's because you're meditating. That adds a flavour to the food more than anything else. It's not. With all best respects to the cooks, they try their very best. But because you're practicing meditation, that is what makes the food more delicious. And little by little, you become really mindful. You actually feel your body. You can look at the stars at night. You can feel the wind on your face. And it's not like the ordinary way you feel the wind on your face. It's also why we try and keep quiet, we don't talk to one another, because that distracts us from living life, from actually feeling. For those of you who don't have smelly feet, please take your socks off and just walk on the bamboo, on the yoga mats out there, or on the concrete surface of the walkways. Feel. Get to know what it's like to be really alive. You know, sometimes that
We're not allowed to feel honestly anymore. You go in shopping centres and it's all air-conned. You can't feel cold, you can't feel hot. You can't even know silence. It's all pipe music somewhere or other. And half of life is just taken away from you. You come into a forest where there's no music other than the sound of the kookaburras or the birds. They are birds, by the way. There's no other feelings you have to worry about except, again, the wind or the sun. You become more naturally alive. And it's beautiful. So after a while, when you become more aware, you have much more energy. Sometimes noticing the connection between energy and happiness. We all know that from its opposite, when it's depression. When you're depression, you just got no energy at all. And even the sunshine, been there, done that. Sunshine's dangerous, you'll catch skin cancer or something. Water, have a glass of water, has all sorts of bugs in it. It's quite good in this place. We've got this, what's it called, UV filter. So this is rainwater here. It's really well sort of filtered and settled and goodness knows whatever. This is really some of the best water you can possibly drink in this place. So it hasn't got any other chemicals in, has it, Prem? It's wonderful. So sometimes you drink the water, it's just so sweet and pure. And the air is just so pure. And sometimes you really get off on that. Just to be able to just go and sit by the lake down there and just watch. I don't know what's in there at the moment. Has anyone seen the crocodile in there yet? There's no crocodile in there. I don't know what's in there, but there's just sometimes a few ducks, if you're lucky. But it's just so peaceful. And when you're aware, you can notice all of that, and it's joyful. Remember just what I said, going up Kingsbury Drive that time, and I stopped because, and as I stopped that hillside, I saw things I'd never seen on that hillside before, and they're all so beautiful and delightful. That is a sign that mindfulness is happening. You're aware of so much more, and what you see is just so much more beautiful, and it's delightful. Which means you can stay with it. You don't need to have entertainment. It's all around you. So, first of all, before I get off, the four foundations of mindfulness, having overcome or lessened the hindrances which weaken wisdom and stop stillness, so said the Buddha. As those five hindrances get really less, you can look at your body and relax it, which is first Satipatthana practice. As many of you do, you scan your body, you feel your body. Oh, this body's done such a lot of good work for me over 69 years. You know, it's really done well. And just working hard, doing good things, teaching, traveling, building, writing. So thank you, Hans, you did a really good work. So all that hard work which your body has done, I'm grateful for it. And when I look at it, I give it gratitude. Thank you, Lise. I'm really so surprised, 69 years and I can still sit cross-legged with no pain on my knees. Really well done. When I say things like that, I don't know if it's my imagination, you feel your knees saying thank you for appreciating me. And you know, any aches or pains, slight ones, they just release. You feel really good in that area. That kindness and just my butt, my tummy, yeah, it's a bit big, but that's you know your fault. I mean, it really is. Because you know, sometimes, oh, please eat this, please eat this, please eat this. It's really good. Well, I don't mind. But you know, inside it's really healthy. You know, really, you know if you're sick. You can feel aches and pains in there, just is working fine. I always have very good digestion and just going to toilets, it's always great. So, you know, because I really know how to let go. I've been training and letting go for so many years. So I never have any sort of trouble with constipation and stuff like that. Now, honestly, that sometimes people are in too much of a rush when they go to the loo. And that's what causes your problems. I respect my body. So however long you need, that's how long you can take. I'm not going to rush you. And you relax. Really relax. And it's so wonderful. You relax so much. No tightness and tension. Whatever comes out just comes out nice and easy. So constipation or diarrhea just aren't in my experience as a monk. And then I've eaten some really terrible stuff, but it seems the body does okay. So you're aware of your body, and you can relax it all. Everything from the tip of the toes to my nose to my eyes, everything. One of the things which I do when I do a body scan, which is first Satipatthana, getting to know your body, is to really relax it, let it go. One of those things which I do, a little imaginary exercise, I imagine my poor brain. Oh, you have to make so many decisions, and sometimes people ask you, well, you know, you're the boss, so you have to make the decision, what should you do? And you try and make that decision, you have to think about this, and think about that, and think about something else. Now these days, what I do, and if you have to make decisions, put all the information in, and then forget about it. Now this is serious, because when I just get all the information in, and forget about it for a day or two, then the answer comes up, and it's usually a very good decision. But I don't worry about thinking about it. I just leave it alone, and the answer comes up by itself. It just computes. I don't rush it. And usually get some really good answers that way. So, but my poor brain has to do a lot. I'm spiritual director, not dictator. There are quite a few organisations. They always ask me these questions, and I just forget about them until a good answer comes up. But sometimes my poor brain has a lot to do. It's getting old now. It's about time my brain had a break. So what I imagine doing in meditation is just opening up my skull as if it's got a hinge and open it up, take my brain out, put it, you know, on a nice little cushion somewhere, a nice blanket, tuck it in and say, you know, see you again in an hour's time. I'm meditating now. Some way of giving your brain a bit of a rest or a holiday. Because even though you're meditating, you know, how many times do you start thinking and solving problems and working out, you know, what to do if Mr. Trump gets elected, or what to do if, you know, you lose all your money while you're away, what to do if your partner runs away with somebody while you're on retreat? I don't know what you think about. But you can waste so much time thinking about stupid stuff, which never happens. And so after a while, you sort of take your brain out, put it down, and have a rest. So that's body awareness. Learning how to calm the body, leave it alone. You know it's inside if it creates calm. You understand? It's just a body, that's all. It doesn't belong to you. Just leave it alone. Don't worry about it. And then, if you look at the Satipatthana, they say, the first of those Satipatthana on the body, they say, just watch your breath. Hey? I thought breath meditation was calm, samatha, not insight. That's the first one in the insight meditation, watch the breath. There is no difference. So when you're watching the breath, that's what you're doing. You're watching the body and you're calming it down. Calming your breath down. You're calming your body down. Standard Satipatthana practice. And then what happens? Suppose the next one you're supposed to do, the Vedana Sati, they call it feelings, on experience. So how can you do that? As you're breathing in, it's delightful breath. Breathing out, delightful. With piti, with sukha. What's becoming prominent now? It's a feeling of pleasure with watching the breath. And weird. That's why some people feel you monks and nuns are really, you know, get a life, you know, just watching your breath all day. You should be watching just the movies We're watching, is it? Actually, there is no sports things anymore, are there? Because all the sports have been cancelled because of COVID. It's a great time to meditate because there's nothing else to do. There never was anything else to do anyway. But still, people watch all these things to try and get some pleasure from here and pleasure from there. Like, if you could go travelling, what do you really want to go and see? Have any of you seen the Great Wall of China? Do you want to go and see the Great Wall of China? No need to see the Great Wall of China. Go to Bodhinyana Monastery. See the Great Wall of Bodhinyana. It's pretty long. What's the difference? Wall's a wall. How many of you have seen Niagara Falls? If you haven't seen Niagara Falls, go and see Serpentine Falls. It's much closer. Same thing, just water falling over a cliff. What's the difference? Seen the Grand Canyon? Want to see the Grand Canyon? Go and look at some of the erosion on this China Grove site. The canyon's here, canyon's there. In other words, I remember just going to see, because we went on pilgrimage once, and they took us to, what's it called, Taj Mahal. And I was, the other person who went inside there, she was standing next to me. We took a look at it. And she said to me, and I will always remember this, and I really respect her for saying this. She says, it's a bit OTT, isn't it? A bit over the top. I said, yeah, well done. Because everyone said it's a beautiful thing. And because you think it's a beautiful, you've got to say the same thing. Oh, it's beautiful. It's, oh, yeah, it's beautiful. You're just buying into other people's judgment. But the amount of money that took just ruined so much of people's lives. And you know what it was for? Is because, what was it, the Sultan or the, what was he called in those days? Anyway, the boss, you know, he fell in love and his missus died. And he did that all for her. That's a bit OTT. Anyway, that's maybe because I'm a monk. I'm not sensitive to the loss. No, I shouldn't say things like that, I get into trouble. Actually, I'm already in trouble, so I don't mind. But anyway, just all the happiness and the beauty of meditation. See, great joy is there. You understand what happiness is. The Vedanusati, the second Satipatthana. And who'd have ever thought, like I said last night, a piece of feces can be just so gorgeous at all levels. That is where you get insight into the second Satipatthana of happiness and joy. Things which shouldn't be but are, they really shock you. And the third Satipatthana, the mind. Many people try to practice the mind contemplation. They don't even know where to look. What is your mind? I mentioned that to you already about, you know, are you happy, are you sad? Can you please point to your mind? You all got it wrong. And I asked about that wonderful statement by one of my five-year-old genius. The mind is the biggest thing, not in the world. Because everything you can ever know, everything you can ever experience, anything you can ever talk about can fit into your mind. Therefore, it's the biggest thing, not in the world. Even time can fit into your mind. Time is another amazing stuff. If your desire disappears or gets less, time changes its meaning. In fact, if you have no desires at all, time disappears. It's not meaningful anymore. Time is measured by the intensity of your wanting. Great insights come from the nature of the mind. And when you do the mind meditation, you can't really do the mind Satipatthana without some experience of jhanas. You're going to read what it says, that the person doing the the awareness of the mind, he knows the mind which is in jhana, he knows the mind which isn't in jhana, basically. So you can't do it unless you have some experience of what this jhana is. And what is a jhana anyway? The jhana is where you just got mind, nothing else. No sight, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch. Just the sixth sense, your mind. Alone, pure, not affected by any of the other senses. And that's how the Buddha described it. He said, like a goldsmith would purify the gold of all these other trace elements until it's 100% gold, nothing else but gold. And only then can you find out gold's real qualities. And you can shape it into whatever you want, the goldsmith does. And he said, that's like the mind. And you have just mind, nothing else but mind. Everything else is gone. Then you can get some understanding of what this mind is. What are the insights you get from that? One of the easiest insights is to not be afraid of death. Yeah, the body goes. This mind doesn't go when you die. Sometimes you might say, unfortunately. It takes much more to stop this mind. But at least you're not afraid of dying. And you also understand all these little things like, terminal lucidity? I mentioned that already. That people towards the end of their life, their brain is just, you know, zonked out with morphine. Or they've had a coma. Or like this story, I really should have kept at least some mention of the month and date of this Time magazine. But they had this wonderful article written by a doctor in New York, and his patient had brain tumour, and inoperable, unstoppable. And the brain tumour was developing at such a constant rate that the doctor could actually predict, you know, what would happen, almost, you know, to the time of the death, you know, accurate to the hour. And described to the family, just, we'll lose this function of the body and that function of the body and that function of the body, and so we'll not be able to see you, not be able to speak with you, until the basic functions of heart and brain be the last to go. And see, the tumour just colonises the whole of the brain till there's no brain left. And so they knew the fellow has been in a coma for a few days, unable to speak or see or respond, as the tumour was taking over the rest of the brain. And they knew exactly when the brain would, nothing left, just tumour. So they were, all the family were around him, and the doctor too. And that's when he opened his eyes. And there for about half an hour, 45 minutes, had a nice long conversation with the family, how much he loved them and cared for them, important things in life. 45 minutes, clarity, and expressing the love towards one another. And at that time, he didn't have a brain. It was just tumour between his ears. And the doctor said, this shouldn't happen. I haven't got a clue what's going on, but it happened. He was there, he saw it. And it was one of the most amazing things. It's a very extreme example of terminal lucidity. For such a long time, the brain was not functioning. The mind took over. This jitter, incredible little thing. And little thing, is can't really call it little, but then this is what will... the stream of consciousness, the mind, which will take you to the next life. Or not. It's far more important than the brain. Far more powerful as well. And it's that when you start accessing it and training it, you know what this mind is. That's when you can do zappy things. Zap, zap, zap. There's only a couple of interviews, so I'd go on a bit longer. There are such things as psychic powers in this world. You don't show them. You don't tell what monks have got these things or nuns have got these things until after they die. Because you don't want to harass them. If anybody says they got a psychic power, you spend the rest of your life having to prove it. Mostly in labs. But this monk I knew, he's dead now. He's the Indonesian monk, Sudama, his name was. And not Sri Lankan lady, Sudama, who cooks it. Not her, but this was an Indonesian man. And he was a great fellow because, you know, because I go to Indonesia a lot, you know, I knew all about him. And he was just this layperson who decided to be like a rishi, just not ordaining in any religion, but just going off into the jungles when Java did have jungles and just meditating. And he told me his story. Now, gives you some idea of trouble with language sometimes. But, you know, when he described it to me in his language, which he understood pretty easily, he said he went off into the jungle, sat down, and soon he got into a very still state of mind, really peaceful. He said this star came to him. This incredible, brilliant, beautiful star came into his mind. That's classical nimitta. I wouldn't call it a star. I would say like a brilliant nimitta, like a star would come in. And then he said he married that star. Now, that was his way of describing, just, you know, going into it, really getting inside of it. And then he said that when he came out of his meditation, the forest around him had all changed. It was weird, you know. It's like, you know, you go to meditation in this room here, and afterwards it's different. No, it really is different. And apparently he'd been meditating for about 6 or 7 days, and there was a flood. You know, a flash flood in that valley where he was meditating. He didn't know anything about it. But afterwards he could see the damage on the trees and all the litter on the ground. And he worked out he'd been underwater for I don't know how many days. Didn't matter. Because when you're in those deep meditations, you're hardly breathing or not breathing at all. And you are can't be harmed. Anyway, he eventually became a monk because of that, and really a powerful monk. You know, maybe because I was sensitive to that part of life. As soon as I first saw him, I turned around and said, wow, that monk is really powerful. And then I found out who it was. And anyway, what he did once, I wasn't there, but the person who told me was a Thai princess, a granddaughter of one of the kings. So, you know, and trusted her immensely. She said, this is not a lie. That she was on a meditation a day with this monk in Wat Bawan in Thailand. And no, she's just meditating, like, you know, I sometimes lead the meditations, and she was meditating there nice and peacefully, and then she felt that something was up, something was going on in the room. You know, sometimes you feel like something's happening. So she opened her eyes and she freaked out. Because she said that from this monk's eyes, there was these laser lights coming out into another meditator. The monk with the laser eyes, like light beams coming out. And this was not a sort of a person who took drugs or anything. This was a Thai princess. And that's what she said. And she never went back there again. So scared. That's one of the reasons why, if you do have psychic powers, Venerable, don't show them. So that is some. Oh, the last Satipatthana is actually, this is great work by people like Ajahn Bhumali and Ajahn Sujata, who just got all these other versions of the suttas, and some of the Chinese versions, and the older versions, you know, in libraries and stuff. And they found out that the earliest version, which we say is the original version of the Satipatthana, the fourth one, was only contemplating two things, the five hindrances and the seven enlightenment factors, that's all, nothing else. All the other things which we have these days were added on, there's nothing wrong with them. But it takes the emphasis away from the importance of the five hindrances. That's what's blocking you. And that's why the Satipatthana want to know what those are and how they're overcome. And when those are overcome, you have the seven enlightenment factors take their place. And that's Satipatthana. Like you've never heard it before. With a few psychic powers, a few silly stories like the carrot joke. You know why I do this? It's because you tell the funny stories. I got this from the Tibetan monk a long time ago. He said that he tells jokes, funny stories, because when people are laughing, when their mouths are open, that's when he can put in the pill of Dhamma. There's a joke, what goes on in between, that's the Dhamma. I'm telling a joke every now and again. That helps you absorb the Dhamma. And sometimes you think you already remember the jokes, but the other stuff has already been put in. Sadhu. 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 Oh, there's only three he's. Come on. He. Very good. Okie dokie. So have a wonderful morning, and we do have a... Oh, we still have the interviews. And today and tomorrow and this afternoon. And a question and answers this evening. Anything you didn't understand or you want to pick me up on or didn't say properly or whatever, you can put them on the question sheets this evening. Story about what? The money from the... The chickens. Oh, chicken shit.
Yeah, the money.
The money. The chicken shit. Okay. But before I tell the story, you've got to tell me it. Yeah.